So here we are. It's week 4 of session 10, and we are reading, just as last week we read pretty much the opening pages of Time, Space, and Knowledge, this week we're reading the opening pages of Sacred Dimensions. And there's a lot here. The approach that we find in Sacred Dimensions, in some ways, maybe not everybody would agree. I don't know, but in some ways, I think it's in terms of starting things off, it's the most radical departure from our ordinary way of seeing. Because we'll see. We'll talk about that a little bit. So it requires some careful thinking and reflecting, but it seems really important not to do that thinking and reflecting in the sense that we're trying to figure out an intellectual puzzle, you know, something. I mean, of course, we've said this many times with TSK, we're not talking about some abstract theory. We're looking for ways to activate a vision. And I think that's why I suppose I find the approach in sacred dimensions to be the most challenging, because it does seem really abstract. You know, suddenly we're talking about points and lines, which that happens in a lot of the TSK books, but we're talking about a kind of a geometry. And the question is, what does that have to do with the way I live my life? You know, roughly speaking, that's the question. So that's part of what we want to look at, but we do need to take some time, it seems to me, to make sure we're clear about what Rinpoche is doing here in this first chapter. And then at the same time, we need to be asking, what is the significance of that? I will say that I've always found for myself Sacred Dimensions to be probably the most challenging book, and that's partly because I was not, there were three of us who were editors of this book, and it's a remarkable, it came together very quickly. Rinpoche pushed very hard. He had three of us here, he had three of us with him. He was dictating to all three of us at the same time, mostly, I think. I recall, but everybody processed things a little bit differently. So in the end, there was a lot that I hadn't really had a chance to digest when the book came out, or at least not quite in the same way. So I find it challenging. I don't know about you all. It's my impression that people have found the material challenging. So all the more reason for us to take some time to elaborate it. I'm going to work through this first section, the first part of the reading, pages 3 to 11, and it probably won't be till the end of that we get to doing some practice, so we probably won't get to the other sections today. Okay, so we start with the I am here. Right, as Hayward already pointed out before the class started, and that's not unusual in the TSK books. In fact, in Love of Knowledge, Rinpoche also talks about that as the founding knowledge, the thing that we're really the most sure of. You know, I think he may have said, "Here I am," instead of "I am here." I don't think that makes a big difference, but the challenge that Rinpoche sets here, and this is right on in the first page, he says, so how we have this fundamental axiom of first-level knowledge, and we want to open that axiom. We want to start with the I am here and not say, you know, this is a first-level view that we need to discard, or this is a first-level view that's too limiting or something like that. It's saying, no, let's find a way to actually work with that and say that is where we're our starting point. What can we do with that starting point? And then that takes him off into this rather unusual way of talking. I want to take a moment to reflect on the word axiom, because I think it's helpful. So he says on page 3 that this is the fundamental axiom, right? It's on line 3. This fundamental axiom of first-level knowledge, I am here. So just briefly, because he doesn't go into it exactly, although he does do some similar kinds of inquiry. First of all, if you look at the word axiom, and it has the X at the center, right? The unknown. I think it's actually appropriate to call attention to that, because Rinpoche likes to play with the X. He likes to use the X as the unknown and what marks the spot, but also because an axiom is, in a sense, ungrounded. You know, it's like in geometry, an axiom is what you have to take for granted. You have to start from the axiom, and then you can build build the rest of the system from the axiom, but there's no way to derive the axiom. Its origin is unknown. We just have to kind of accept it. And usually we accept it because it seems to make sense to us. And here we have this fundamental axiom. There's a quote. I looked around a little bit at some of the other places that the word axiom is used in the TSK writings. And Rinpoche, toward the very end of Knowledge of Time and Space, on page 471, he is talking about the point of access, and of course there's a little play on words there between access and axiom. He says, the point of access to great knowledge, if it does exist, I'm not going to go into that, must in principle remain unknown, the axiomatic X that puts in place the defining borders of the world that's accessible to first-level knowledge. So there's this axiom at the center, and it's unknown in the sense that we just have to take it for granted. And he says here it puts in place the defining borders of the world that's accessible to first-level knowledge. And that's actually, in a very literal way, what Rinpoche plays with here, is the idea that the eye establishes borders, and it does so in this move that he makes, which we'll talk about a little more in a minute, where he says, well, if you tip the eye over, if you turn it on its side, then what you've created is a line that's defined by these two border lines, which is, and that's the shape of the eye. So the axiom puts the borders in place. And if you look at the word axiom, it's really pretty interesting. I was surprised. The word axiom means authority. In the Greek, it means authority, axioma. But more literally, it means, apparently, I'm just quoting you from the dictionary, it means what is worthy. And if you go back even further, it's related to the word for weighty, for having weight. And I thought that was very interesting, because the word guru in Sanskrit actually means heavy or weighty. So it's like the central point, the weighty thing that anchors everything else. So the axiom is almost like the guru of the system. I mentioned that for what it's worth. I just found it interesting. So you have this axiom. And the point of what he's doing here is he's saying, okay, this is the thing it seems as though we can't question, the I that is here, the I am here. And then he asks, what can we do with it? We can work with it, right? He says, at the end of that first paragraph, if we let the knowledge that I am here expresses speak. So I am here expresses some knowledge. If we let that knowledge speak, what does it have to tell us? So he wants to kind of unpack the knowledge that's in the I am here. And it's a beautiful example, really, of how Rinpoche operates, raising questions where people usually never think to raise questions. So you want this axiom, this I am here, and you want to let it speak. And so he starts to do this. The approach that he uses is based on this kind of funny geometry. Right? I think on page 10, he talks about it as a kind of geometry. One moment. Well, maybe he doesn't use the word at that very place. He uses it somewhere. You know, what we have is we have points and we have lines and we have the zero and we have the 16 and we have cones. This is the geometry that we're working with. And the way that he starts to explore it is by letting... Here's this I, and so the I is the zero point, you could say. And then he says, but if you tip it over, then you have a line. And there are two points marked out on the line, the head and the foot of the I. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is, of course, that it only works in English, right? And Rinpoche acknowledges that. He says, we're working in we're using English. English, he says, is the language of our inquiry. So it's not a logical point. You can't say, well, the I establishes this world, you know, this baseline with two limits, because it doesn't work in any other language. You know, he tried to do it with ich in German or with yo in Spanish. I think it must be close in Portuguese. It never works. So it's not as though he's trying to prove something here. He's being kind of playful, and he says very specifically, he says, you know, this isn't meant to be a big deal. This letter designates the point of view of the self, the letter I. He says, perhaps, this is at the top of page 4, perhaps we can take this as a message from knowledge, an indication that our line of inquiry may prove fruitful. So it's just playing with the language and seeing, oh, this is kind of interesting. What if you do this? You know, it's not as though you say, oh, now I've established that the, you know, this is the way we can prove the axiom. No, it's just a way of thinking, a way of engaging it. So it's playful, of course, it's also serious. And, you know, he said before, we want to let the knowledge of I am here speak. So when it speaks, it turns out that it speaks English. Not because English is special in some way, but because that's how Rinpoche has written the book. And it's funny, it's interesting, as an editor, you know, and for me, speaking as an editor, you know, none of that can be translated. The starting point of the book is really impossible to translate. The only thing you could do is have a footnote where you said, well, the reason this makes sense in English is all, and then you'd explain it all. So it's a starting point, but it's not a necessary starting point. It's just one that presents itself to him when he embarks on this task of letting knowledge speak. So, okay, we're going to let knowledge speak. And we have this I, and it's fallen over, and it's created a line for us, and two points on the line, which are defined by the head and the foot of the I. And what you've done is, you've established a structure in space, and at the same time, you've set limits in that structure. I saw something yesterday that talked about the self as being, is like someone who is living in prison and is very proud of his prison cell because it's so big, you know. But he's kind of ignoring the fact that the cell confines him and leaves him caught in this prison. And the eye, as an image for this, is similar. David gave me the reference here, I see in the chat room. It's on page 9. Asking the question that we are asking here, how can an inquiry, this is a quote, how can an inquiry that starts with a kind of space geometry lead to a new way of being? So you might well say that it seems as though we're going to this incredible level of abstraction. And one of the points that I want to try to really make clear here today, or help at least investigate here today, is how it is that that what we're doing is not abstract, even though it sounds very abstract. There's a line. Well, forget. I'm not going to go into that. Okay. So you could say that the starting point is arbitrary, and that's okay because our starting point is always arbitrary. You know, and in a certain sense, if you take it back into the reality of the I am here. In other words, I am here is it's true for you. It's true for me. It's true for anybody. It's the axiom, but it's always an arbitrary axiom because your I am here is different from my I am here. So wherever we start the inquiry, we're starting from a place of that has just been pointed out in this kind of arbitrary way. If I had another word, I'd use it, but that's what comes to mind. You have your starting point, which is different from my starting point, but it's also the same. In the sense that it's the I am here. It's when we get to the content, there's no reason why I would want to start with my I am here, except that it's my I am here. And in the same way, you could say there's no reason we'd want to start by tipping over the I, tipping over the letter I, except that it happens to work in English. It doesn't work anywhere else. Okay. So I think if you're going to work with this particular image, even if English isn't your native language, you have to be able to say, okay, I get it, I understand how that works, how that would work in English. So we have the I am here, that's the axiom, and then that axiom gives us a structure, and the structure consists of essentially of a line and two points, right? That's what happens when the I falls over. And then Rinpoche makes this move, which again, in a sense, is arbitrary, where he says we've got a zero point, that's the I of the I am here, but now that we've started to build a structure, we begin to see how that structure opens up and you end up with an axis, and every point in the axis or every point that you establish has endpoints, has four endpoints, right? And so from that four, each of those points has its own four, and so now you have 16. And of course, in principle, you can immediately go on to infinity, right? Every point that you specify, if you think of it as the zero point of an axis, the x and the y axis that we learn about when we study algebra and geometry, every point has to be determined by another axis, and the axis, and Rinpoche goes into this in Knowledge of Time and Space, you could also think of as an X, because in fact it is an X. I mean, the shape of it is an X. Okay, so again, he stops at 16, right? He goes from the zero point to 16, and those of you who've worked with sacred dimensions know that the number 16 becomes very important. But again, it's arbitrary. He could have gone on, because really, I think the first axiom in Euclid's geometry is I may be wrong, but it's at least an axiom, is that through any given point, you can draw an infinite number of lines. And if you think about that, visualize that, that's clearly, that's how we understand our world. That's how we understand what points are. And so you could take the 16 and you could just keep on drawing lines or generating axes. But he stops at 16 and it's a symbol. He uses that as a symbol of the whole, of completion, right? When you get to 16, that's the fullness of the whole, and that's the way he describes it. And so the point that he makes here is that any zero point, it can expand out into wholeness, and that means in this context could expand out into 16, because 16 is the symbol of that wholeness. Ken McKeon makes a reference to the Seinfeld show, and I must say I don't know the show well enough to understand this, but I'm going to read it for people so that it's in the record, as it were. Seinfeld's Kramer, one of the characters, might propose a 100-yard dash in which each runner had a different starting point. Well, that is exactly our situation. As I say, I don't quite get the reference, but you know, we all have our own starting point. You know, I mentioned this once before, but it's a point that ultimately traces to a Buddhist thinker saying that I is a very surprising word, because everybody knows precisely what it means. It's the starting point for everyone, but it means something different for everyone. Meaning is completely clear and at the same time completely mysterious, because my I is not your I, and so on. So we have this duality of 0 and 16. And they mirror each other. What he actually says, let me take a look at it, is that the whole, the 16, which remember is just a symbol for the whole, traces back to 0. He says, the top paragraph on page 5, he says, this whole construction, based on the I am here, as 0 point, remains fully reducible to 0. And it works in both directions. Without the 0 point, you could never develop lines or cones. And until you've developed lines and cones and all of these shapes, you can't locate 0. Right? So you can move it in both directions. And he ends that paragraph by saying, we could consider the whole of this interdependent structure a reflection of 0. So you have the whole and you have 0, and that's its own kind of duality, you could say. So what happens is you have the 0 point, but you generate a whole. And that whole is the world that we know. So the I am here already contains within it the whole world, because you're able now to generate that whole world. So it's a little different, or you might say fundamentally different, from what we all learn about Descartes, that he said, I think, therefore I am. And so he said, the one thing I can be sure of, and what he was saying there was, the one thing I can be sure of is my own existence, because even if I question my existence, I have to accept that I'm the one who's doing the questioning. So that's a little problematic, but we won't go into that now. But basically what happens is, he's got the 0, right? The I is the 0. But he makes the assumption that I is cut off from everything else. Whereas Rinpoche, by starting with the I am here, doesn't have to do that. And in fact, is moving in the opposite direction, because he's saying that the I am here already embodies or engages the whole. And it's actually interesting, I hadn't thought of this until this moment, that there's a movement in the consciousness studies, in the philosophical inquiry into consciousness nowadays, to say that exactly what Descartes got wrong is that any I is embodied. Right? We can't imagine that the I is cut off from the world. And although Rinpoche doesn't talk here about embodiment, he's talking about geometry, it's the same point. The I and the 16 are reciprocal. And because that's so, you have this starting point of the I am here, and from that you build up a whole world. But you do it in this very abstract way. And I'm only using the word abstract here temporarily, because as he points out later, it's not exactly abstract. But it is abstract in the sense that you're not talking about anything, you're not talking about my world in the way that we would usually think of my world, because we'd say, well, you know, I'm located in this room and I know these people and I have this history. Those are the things that would seem to ground our experience. And he stays at a completely different level. He stays at a geometric level. Right? He says, this is on page 8, in the first full paragraph. He says, all we're doing is listening to a story that's told by knowledge or watching a play that's put on by time and presented by space. Those are both nice ways of saying it. And then he says, now here's the cast of characters. Zero point, axes, baseline, and cone, 16, and ratio. Ratio we're not going to talk about at all today. It's not really in this reading. And then he says, or you could think of it in terms of time and space and knowledge. And then he makes this very interesting point. He says, well, what about the I? You know, I thought we were talking about I. That was our starting point, the axiom, the I am here, right? And he says, yeah, the I is there, but it doesn't play the central role. You know, he uses the metaphor of a play here, and he says, the I am here has a role to play, but it may not be the one for which it thought it was auditioning. So here we are at the beginning, and it turns out that the axiom I am here doesn't necessarily mean that the I is at the center of everything. You know, the I was auditioning for the main part, but in fact, you've built a play in which the it's a little bit like saying if you were going to talk about an element, let's say iron. And you thought your job was to talk about the properties of iron, how hard it is, and I don't know how it gets made, you know, the process through which it's manufactured. But in fact, what you're going to talk about is the atoms and molecules that go to make up iron. So we're working at a very different level. We're working with the I am here, but we're not working with it in terms of the story about the I that usually gets told. That's what it means now to talk about a kind of space geometry. You know, we're working on this level that is not the usual level where we have identified what matters to us, our concerns, and all of that. So it's actually a lot like, it seems to me, like working with algebra. You know, we've talked about the XY axis, and we've talked about the axis. I held up my fingers, but I guess you can't see it. They're there. The XY axis. He doesn't talk about, he doesn't name them in that way, but, you know, usually when you learn geometry, you know, there's the X axis going horizontally, the Y axis going vertically. I think we're all familiar with that. You could also talk more generally about the X and the Y of that you find in algebra or geometry. When you talk about X and Y, you're not naming anything specific, because an X, by definition, what's the word you use there? The X and the Y can stand for anything, right? So there's no specificity at all. If I say X equals Y, I haven't said anything, because X could be anything, and Y could be anything. And it's only when you assign the specific definition, you know, to what X is and what Y is, that you're starting to make any claims. X equals Y is just a kind of a structure. And that's what's going on here. He's operating on this, in this space geometry, in which the X and the Y, or he doesn't use that, sorry, in which instead of having this kind of fully embodied world with my concerns and my interests and all of that, we're operating at this level which seems, as I've said many times now, it seems very abstract. And the benefit of doing that, he goes into at the very bottom of page 7 and the top of page 8, why would you do this? He says, well, so why would it be fruitful to do this? He says, One reason is that we're not moving to the objective realm. That is, we're not leaving the I am here out of account. But we're also not taking the what we usually think of as the subjective dimension too seriously. You know, he says we don't move, this is the top of page 8, we don't move to the objective pole of knowledge too quickly, but we also don't get caught up in the endless webs of first-level subjectivity. So, in the specific sense of that we're talking about here, by staying with the X and the Y, or I'm sorry, I really shouldn't bring those in exactly, although I see people are commenting in those terms too, but by just staying with the geometry of the I am here, the points and the lines and the cones, the zero point, the 16, we don't have to get lost in my concerns, my meaning, my history, all of that. We're operating with subjective structures, but without accepting the truth of what those structures are then hooked up to. So, Sudhi says, it's abstract. That's right, the XYZ way, because there's no specific X, Y, and Z. Yeah, that's exactly, I think that's what I was trying to point to. So Michael says, 16 starts with the duality, self and other, here and there, then proceeds to scramble it through extension into a community of points that are each central to their own existence within the whole. The effect is to provide a world for a particular I, while emphasizing the importance of relationship in place of our usual individual perspective. Well, that's a good and important point to make. You know, and it's similar to what I said before, that it's very different to say our starting point is I am here, rather than the Cartesian starting point of saying I exist, because Descartes is then stuck with his self, and he's got to figure out a way to move beyond the self. But we start with a self that is located, that is embodied or spread out, and therefore the possibility of relationship is always already there. And Michael's making a similar point, coming at it very differently, if I understand, which is that because in every point there's a possible infinity of points, then the points are always in relationship to one another. And so we have automatically, you could say, moved beyond our individual perspective. Okay, so I do want to say at the same time, though, that, you know, I've said this is very abstract in the sense that we're not tied to specific content, but it's also not abstract, because we really are trying to stay true to the reality of the I am here, my own felt sense of being here, you know, of the I, of the am, and of the here. And Rinpoche talks about that a little bit here in this chapter, but I'm not going to go into it right now. I think what he's trying to offer here is a way that we can explore the structure that we insist on as fundamental, the I am here, without getting caught up in our particular subjective concerns. So there's no psychology here at all, obviously, you know, because if you're really just talking about points and lines and 0 and 16, there are no particulars. There's no, I was born on such and such a day in such a place, or you know, I have such and such an identity. None of that is there. And yet at the same time, we're not turning away from that subjective center. As he says on page 7, the I am here is the lens through which we look out onto the world. And of course that leads him then to a point that we won't say much about right now, and that is that the lens could be faulty. You know, the lens could be distorted. It could give us a distorted view. And if so, wouldn't it be important to know that? And so again, this is a kind of pointing toward a possible direction for inquiry, which is to understand the I am here differently, and in that way to be able to look out onto the world in a different way. So that's why Rinpoche can say on page 10 that, you know, we're doing a kind of an objective inquiry here, in the sense that we are not doing a subjective inquiry. You know, our own concerns are not what's guiding us here. So we've talked about this before. Science likes to say that its inquiry is objective because it eliminates the biases of the self. And Rinpoche is offering a different way to do something quite similar. I'm adjusting my picture a little because, for some reason, the light seems very strong, and I imagine it's maybe hard for you to see me. I'm trying to make it better. I think I just made it worse. Try going back. Okay. So it's, you could think of it as being objective, but you also have not departed from the understanding of the self. So on page 10, he looks into that, and he makes the point that I think is really the point you have to add, which is that this is not abstract in the sense that we've left our concerns behind. You know? He says, if we take this lead, this is the second paragraph on page 10, that is, if you approach things in terms of this space geometry, then you stay true to the space. You stay true to space, and this is the first time I've brought in the term space, I think. He's saying that, you know, by staying with the geometry, we're kind of operating in the space world. We're not operating in an identity world, in a substance world. And so he says, if we take this lead, we can investigate the I am here without turning it into an abstraction. And then he starts to suggest that, you know, we're not just kind of running away from the truths of our own existence, the things that we take for granted. He says, we can rely on the experience of our body and our senses, not because they give us truth about what is there, but because they are vital to our here. And he takes it in a direction that may seem really surprising if you say, well, gee, we've been talking in these geometric terms. He says, still in that same paragraph, we can question vigorously, but we can also appreciate what space makes available, and our appreciation can deepen into love. And that's very surprising, and I think in terms of, at least to me, and I think in terms of you know, how space, how this book, Sacred Dimensions, works, it's very, this is the place where you really would want to reflect. You know, we're investigating the dimensions of appearance, but and that's the dimensions, you could say, but we're not leaving out the realm of meaning and significance. But we're approaching them in a way that lets us stay true to their space origins. Right? We're not caught up in the reality, in the usual realities of substance that you know, shape our usual understanding. So that gives us the opportunity or the possibility of appreciation, which can deepen into love. That's the challenge in sacred dimensions, it seems to me. And he talks about it again at the very bottom of page 10, and let's look at that. Let's look a little bit above that, the last full paragraph. He says, in psychological terms, so we haven't been talking psychologically, but if you were going to look psychologically, this means that life becomes more rich, but we're not being psychological, we're not returning to subjectivity. But what happens is that we can accept the fundamental axiom, I am here, but leave it open, as he says here, to being an expression of space-time knowledge, not an abstract proposition, but the truth of our being. And then he goes on to say, what we're doing is we're letting the here in I am here, because that's the space dimension, we're letting it open into the fullness of space, the juncture that presents the zero point, that then becomes the whole. Right? So this is meant to be a way in which the zero point of space, which we have talked about over these last weeks, can also become the manifestation of the whole. This is how he's doing this, how he's trying to do this in these opening pages of Sacred Dimensions. And again, he reminds us that that's not an abstract inquiry. He says about five lines down on page 11, the space and senses and perception we ordinarily operate open differently, ready to accommodate joy. We find that we are at home in the universe. So that's what's so interesting about Sacred Dimensions, it seems to me. We do this, what sounds like a very abstract operation, and we're always trying to figure out, kind of scratching our heads, saying, what does he mean by the zero point, and what does he mean by cones, and what does he mean by 16, and the ratio, and it's all this kind of strange talk that doesn't make sense in our ordinary way. But it's all meant to lead us toward an appreciation of space and time and knowledge that open into love. It's meant to open our senses so that we can accommodate joy. It's meant to bring us home. So that's the challenge, and I think that's really quite lovely. David asks, wouldn't the psychology aspects be other 16s as part of a net of 16s, interactions of cones? Well, I think that's more than I'm prepared to say anything about today. But remember, we're only at the starting point of this. And we're just, given the nature or the structure of the course, we're looking in the last week and this week too, we're looking at some alternative ways that Rinpoche has of engaging the wholeness, the fullness, the richness of space, because that's our theme. This is an introduction to that notion. I'm not prepared to say more, but if you would like to, David, if you'd like to say something right now about how that might work, that's fine. Or maybe in the online. Sudhi says, Rinpoche is bringing in the two dimensions of subjective or relative and the absolute or the objective dimension of our potentiality of experience and human embodiment. Experience. Yes, he is bringing in. I would hesitate to put subject to line it up so that subjective means the relative level and objective means the absolute. You might say that if you were very careful with your language, but the way he uses the word objective usually is not quite that. But there is a kind of a difference that's being talked about here, and you could think about these different dimensions of our experience. Okay, so why is this? And then, let's see, I'm still trying to get to the point where we can practice a little bit with this for just a couple of minutes, but as I expected, we're running out of time. Let me just say one thing, and then we'll try to do a very short practice anyway. Why is this way of expressing this space geometry, why does that lead into appreciation, love, joy? Because we stay open, or we open into the whole of space. Right? And what happens is that we never depart from zero. That's the key phrase, I guess, that I would use. So on page 10, if I can find it here, yeah, at the top of page 10, he's put space at the center now, and he's talking about the zero point. And he says the zero point establishes nothing, but it still allows form to unfold. The process through which zero expands into 16, radiating forms and structures that never depart from zero, parallels the way that conventional space allows an infinite play of appearance to manifest. So it's that the zero radiating out into the wholeness of 16. That's the kind of guiding image, especially here in this early discussion in sacred dimensions of space. That's what he's really wanting to offer here. And if we can appreciate that, if we can get a felt sense of how everything stays at zero, everything is a kind of in geometric terms, whatever manifests, and it always has as its core the I am here, stays in the openness of the zero point. And we've talked a lot about the zero point over the last few weeks, so I hope you've got a sense of that. We don't have enough here, I don't think, to talk about it too much if we were just confining ourselves to the discussion here. But we have more to work with. Remember, this is just the first few pages of Sacred Dimensions. So we have some background to work with that. And so when the zero point expands into the fullness or the whole of 16, the forms and structures, everything that shows up, and so this means our world, our experience, whatever we engage, it never departs from zero. And there's another way of saying that is it never departs from space. And so the result is, you could say, that as we open into space, space enters our hearts. And so there's something, again, people sometimes look at sacred dimensions and they say, it's so abstract. Right? But it's not. It's meant to let space open in our hearts. That's the phrase that he uses here. I must say I can't find it at the moment, but believe me, trust me, somewhere in here. And then it goes in the direction that Michael pointed out, which is that we are connected with others, right? So at the very bottom of page 10, when we let the here of I am here open to the fullness of space, the juncture that presents the zero, that presents the zero point becomes the meeting point of time and space and knowledge. That's the basis for the appreciation we've been talking about. And the baseline becomes our connection with others. So it's I think that helps to give a sense of what it is that Rinpoche is pointing out here. If we look at it abstractly, the zero point opens into the I am here, which is this baseline. That's a very impoverished way of understanding. What we need to understand is that each point opens not only into the baseline, but into the whole of everything, which is symbolically, that's the 16. And then he says, when we understand that, this is at the top of 11, he says, and I already read this, the space and senses and perception we ordinarily operate open differently, they accommodate joy, we are at home in the universe. So this play between 0 and 16 is the play of space in time and knowledge, or maybe you could say the play of, you can play with that. There are different ways of saying that. I hope that gets the idea. So, what we're looking at, there's a couple of comments here. Klaus says, I am here abiding in thought. I read that, Klaus, as a statement that there's a lot to think about here. But Michael has a question about the diagram on page 242, and I am not going to try to comment on that now. But I will, since you raised the point, I will look at it in the I'll comment on it in the orientation. So I'm going to make sure I have easy access to that. Okay. Okay, so this is the point at which we would practice if we had any time. I guess I'm not going to try to make that a practice, but I will ask you to do that practice in the coming week. And that practice is, we've already talked about it, essentially. It's that we can use the reflexive relationship between 0 and 16, the fact that the whole of what appears it doesn't depart from 16, from 0, you know, remains the 0 point. We can use that as an interrelationship. We can let whatever appears be an extension of that starting point of the I am here. Right? And what that means is that the whole world, we can embrace the whole world. So that's like, I see now it's actually hard to describe this, so I'm glad we're not trying to do it today, right at this moment. But I would ask you to do it, and I'll try to describe it a little better again in the orientation. But the idea here is that we're embracing the whole as the zero point and as this starting axiom. The I am here does not in any way separate us from everything that appears and puts us in communication with everything that appears. And that's why we're at home in the universe, right? And that's why we can accommodate joy. So that's the practice that we would like to be able to do. And it's very interesting, I think, to compare it. You could think of it as a kind of a comment on the practice in the TSK book that's called intimacy. It's a working out you could say, in much more detail of why we might be able to speak of intimacy and at the same time never depart from that fundamental axiom of I am here. And the result then, there's a nice phrase on page 9. He says this offers a kind of an explosion, a dynamic liberation of light. So I'm not going to try to I'm not going to try to really comment on that. But what he says here, and again, this is the very beginning of the book, after all. But he says when we have begun to put time and space and knowledge at the center, and that's what this whole space-time geometry is meant to do. Then the result from a first-level perspective might be a kind of an explosion, a dynamic liberation of light as being comes alive. I'll let Philip's comment here be the last thing. He says, home, so we're talking here about being at home in the universe, right? Home equals whole plus 0 point plus space plus I, all manifesting simultaneously and continuously and always, always. That's nicely put. Nicely put. I would say yes. I mean, you made that a question, so my answer to your question is yes. And, of course, there's a very simple play on words that is available that kind of expresses this, again, in English. Because the word whole, meaning everything, you know, sounds more or less identical to the word whole, meaning the lack of anything. That's what a whole is. Those come together. The 0 point and the 16 come together. Space and the I come together. The I am here, which is the manifestation of everything, and the unknown X at the heart of the axiom, those come together as well. Okay, we'll stop there for today. Thank you, everybody. And next week we go back into what in a sense is more familiar territory, but I hope it was helpful to get into this. So we'll stop there. Thanks a lot. Take care.